of an individual life. Take that big question and live it out in the smallness of your life. Care for yourself. Tend your sexuality like a garden that lasts for years, moving through seasons of ease, trouble, abundance, and drought. More from Thomas More. A major difference between care and cure is that cure implies the end of trouble. If you are cured, you don't have to worry about what was bothering you anymore. But care has an ongoing sense of attention. There is no end. Many American Christians, I think, tend to get obsessed with the small, and I don't mean the careful tending of our beautifully small lives. We get obsessed with that Levitical whack-a-mole of the 21st century, the detailed rules that we seem to believe must exist somewhere, and instead of following Jesus' finger that points forward toward grace and mercy, we look the direction his back is facing, and we recreate for our context the very laws, punishments, regulatory systems, and corresponding shame, guilt, secrecy, and deviance that he was walking away from. With respect to same-sex sexuality, we often want to fix it, cure it, change it, or celebrate it, affirm it, either of which can have the effect of addressing it once and for all. Thomas More sees this too. Official religion generally reacts to sex with moral concern. I grew up thinking that the only real sin was sex, and that almost anything having to do with sex was morally wrong. Such a strong moral concern on the part of religion must betray an intense involvement with sex, even as the church tries to keep sex within bounds. The moralism in religion's preoccupation with sex covers over intense interest. He calls sex and religion fighting siblings who claim to hate each other. I think this interest is good, and the bounding of sex is also good. Remember, we're going for fulfillment, not abolishment, but an over-focus on behavioral regulation and rules is settling for something too small. The law, small, is supposed to point to grace, big. So let's take our small questions, those sexual issues that keep popping up like moles, and go to where they really point, the big questions of faith. Like, who is Jesus? Is there a God, and how can I know? Am I really loved, and why don't I feel like it? Is there really enough grace for me? This will help us immensely when we go after smaller questions like, what will this church allow me to do or not do? What about this policy, this statement, this budget? The question, is homosexuality a sin, is often framed as a big question, but I think it's really a small one. And remember, my big and small is not about value. It's sort of about scope. We mistake that question as the big one, so big, it's often the only question. It's the one that determines in and out, friend or enemy, maybe even saved or damned. Sometimes people won't even come to a talk like this until they already know what the speaker believes about that question because they don't want to be in the room with somebody who would say yes when they would say no, or vice versa. Let's refocus on a better big question related to that one. What is sexual identity, and why do we believe in it? What are better and worse ways to understand what it means to be human, and what is the place of sexuality in that? So we'll start big. There is no a-cultural vantage point from which any human being can view the world. Christians sometimes claim the Bible is that vantage point, but it just can't be because we read it, and the reader is located in a time and place with a language and a set of symbols. Taking culture seriously means we're all in this together. None of us are above, beyond, or exempt from delighting in and disciplining our sexuality. Perhaps that sounds obvious, but in practice, the very concept of heterosexuality often provides a categorical exemption for some. That is, a person might occasionally sin, but they are, in their essence, moral. Whereas homosexuality is a categorical condemnation. Or we might affirm all sexualities, which, though it's positive instead of negative, is still a judgment that can distract us from the importance of both discipline and delight. We make sense of our sexual feelings by using the language, metaphors, and concepts available in our society. And if we've been successfully enculturated, we take those things for granted. We don't remember ever learning it. It's the air we breathe. It's the water we drink. On the one hand, that's good. That means we belong to a culture. But on the other hand, it means we may have some work to do in learning to see what we've been taking for granted. As Christians, both the Bible and the global historical tradition of Christianity can broaden our cultural range. They can give us new concepts, words, or metaphors that can help us live in our own context with more discernment. Just a brief example that that you might already know. In modern English, when we talk about sex, we talk about doing it, having sex, making love, getting laid. Those verbs, doing, having, making, getting, those are some of the most powerful verbs available in capitalist industrial contexts. It's how we make our money, is by making, doing, getting, and having. In the Old Testament world, the Hebrews spoke of yada. That's the phrase that's used that we, and it means knowing, a deep, intimate kind of knowing. So if you have had sex with someone, forgive my English language, that's what I know to call it, they would call that yada. So sexual intimacy is not something to get, have, or do. It's a way of knowing, and it's a special way of knowing an intimate other. The Hebrew approach can help us see the many ways that we reduce the wonder of human sexual connection into sexual pleasure as an object to get, an action to do, or a thing to be had. The list of important sexual issues in our lives and in the world goes on and on. Abortion, divorce, marriage, chastity, sex trafficking, child marriage, AIDS, sexual violence, sex as a weapon of war, and on and on and on. I want to try to get beneath those specific issues to the underlying framework that supports them, which I believe is one of our key challenges to integrating sex and the sacred. In many churches, we experience immense pressure to get married, debilitating shame and regret over sexual sin that's on a different scale altogether than many other sins. We're ruminating, worrying, even panicking over same-sex sexuality. Why is it so difficult? Because we believe that sex links to human identity. What you do or don't do sexually is who you are. Sometimes, even more strongly, what you want sexually is who you are. That's why my student said, after she had premarital sex one time, that she is damaged goods and she can only hope a man will be gracious enough to take her in marriage someday. It's why a man tried dating a friend of mine but broke up with her because she was divorced. He said he thought he could stand it, but he couldn't. It's part of why many struggle to reconcile or even acknowledge persistent, occasional, or long past same-sex feelings or encounters. They're indicative of a permanent state of identity, an identity we may believe is wrong, flawed, or even damned. And it's in all those magazine pictures you looked at. Buy this, want this, be this, and you'll have a worthy self. Do you remember the It Gets Better campaign? I think it might still be ongoing. Journalist Dan Savage urged anyone and everyone to upload homemade videos encouraging sexual minority teens to hang in there. The last I checked several months ago, 25,000 videos had been posted from ordinary people, celebrities, politicians, including even the president, corporations, universities, have made and sponsored videos that offer encouragement to teens who might be depressed, bullied, or suicidal because of their sexual difference. In addition to its encouraging message, It Gets Better is remarkable because it brings people of diverse ideologies and perspectives together in common cause. Really, regardless of what you think about homosexuality, can't we agree that suicide is tragic and that life is good? But I'm left wondering, what is the it that gets better? Dan Savage refers to LGBT youth as if sexuality is a fixed adjective that appends human identity. But L is very different than G, is very different than B, is very different than T. And each of those letters means something somewhat different to the people who claim them. And for some people, there's significant change over time, significant enough to change letters. The very notion of sexual identity, this idea that people can be divided into groups based on the direction of their sexual feelings, that is a new idea. It's a 19th century medical idea. It's an attempt to use sexuality as a measure of scientific classification and to define normal and abnormal, healthy and deviant, and then craft medical interventions to normalize as many people's sexuality as possible. If you read original sexology texts from the 19th century, you see different kinds of definitions. For example, at one point, heterosexuality was defined as sex within marriage that is not open to procreation. That would be freaky. Or heterosexuality at a different time was defined as sex for someone of the desire for someone of the opposite sex who is not your spouse. What kind of perverts do that? And in both cases, wanting sex without procreation, lusting for someone who's not your spouse, in both cases, those were abnormal medical conditions worthy of treatment. So initially, both heterosexuality and homosexuality were deviant categories. The norm, sex between husband and wife open to procreation, didn't need a name because it was just the norm. That's not even recognizable to us today. The category shifted definition, all in an attempt to say, here's this dimension of human life, the sexual wanting, sexual doing. How can we categorize it and label it in the best way? The labels and understandings that we use, well, if you're still talking about homosexuality and heterosexuality, which those words themselves aren't really as popular as they used to be, those reach back to about 1930. If you're using language like LGBTQ, any kind of acronym or letter, those are only, you know, a couple decades old, if that. And today, some people invent their own sexualities, labels. Some people are unlabeled and have none. Constant flux in the categories over time. But what I'm telling you is that the idea of even having a sexual identity is a culturally new idea. Wanting to do things sexually and doing things sexually is a human universal. Everybody everywhere does that. But how do they talk about it? What does it mean to them? That's the work of culture, and that varies culture by culture. What our culture has come up with in the last 120 years or so is that that domain of human life is much more central than we thought it was. It's actually at the core of what it means to be human. And so we need to know and investigate and label that dimension of life so that we can know who a person really is, and whether they are normal or not, healthy or deviant, saint or sinner. They are inherently categories of judgment. In the Christian tradition, someone just made a comment at work this week about sort of, we've been talking about homosexuality forever. The church has been divided about this forever. And I thought, wow, the word homosexual wasn't in the Bible until 1946. We've only been talking about it for well under a century. What were we talking about before? Certainly we were talking about and disagreeing about sexuality. But consider the difference between a sodomite and a homosexual. A sodomite is a man doing certain kinds of behaviors. His essence is a gender category. He's still a man who happens to be a sodomite. If he stops doing the behaviors that get him the label, then he would drop the label. A homosexual is something very different than a sodomite. A homosexual is a type of person. It's a fixed category. So again, you can have the same kinds of feelings or behaviors happening, although those change as well over time, made sense of in a different way. The kinds of issues that we're stuck with talking about in churches and trying to make decisions about are not long-standing issues. We just started framing them this way, and we're just starting to live our way into some of the conundrums and probably unsolvable problems that sometimes are just the byproduct of our frameworks. Anyway, now we have a whole bunch of sexual identity categories. We're long past the heterosexual, homosexual binary. We've got many different labels and categories at play at the same time. The rapid and constant change we see is not mere semantics. Every label there gets at something somewhat different and frames it in a somewhat different way. Now, this isn't entirely a bad idea, this idea of sexual identity. Part of the reason why sexual identity coalesced to the extent that it did in the second half of the 20th century is that people were being discriminated against, sometimes brutally so, and they didn't have a way to form a collective or a way to come together to try to have better civil rights and try to have a better life in society. Sexual identity exists in part as a rallying point for minorities who experience discrimination. That benefit does come at a cost, though. Whatever label you use, sexual identity categories tell us that what we want is who we are, that desire signals identity. And because in our social context, sex is bound to identity, it's become that way in the church. Instead of rethinking human identity in light of the depth of our religious tradition, for the most part, we've just laid judgments, whether good or bad, on top of social categories that we happen to have been raised with. My encouragement is for people to understand their sexuality in light of God's love for them, instead of understanding their identity in light of their sexuality. It's a decentering of sexuality in human identity, but it's not a dismissal of it. Telling sexual minorities to have no sexual identity, just rather just be Christian, can simply be another form of religious repression that encourages people to deny, ignore, or minimize their God-given drive for intimacy and relationship. Finding your identity, quote, only in Christ, sounds like a great idea, but really, it's neither practical nor possible. I'm a Christian, but there are many other dimensions to my identity, national, professional, family, regional, linguistic, just to name a few. We're human. We're created to have deep ties to people and groups in this world. But also, if I listed off every identity category with which I affiliate, there would still be a remainder. The mysteries of individuality that are never fully known, even by yourself. Following Christ opens up a person to a lifelong journey toward love. It doesn't nail down self-knowledge once and for all. The sexual identity framework, this idea that one's sexual feelings are indicative of oneself, is a modern Western social construct, but that doesn't mean it's not real. It's a social reality, like our political affiliations or the nation-state boundaries we live with. Romans 12, 1 through 2 encourages us to not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. This helps us recognize what is good, pleasing, and perfect. We should use sexual identity categories with discernment, not take them for granted. This means that for some people, claiming a sexual identity is an important part of having a recognizable social role. And for people who have lived closeted, this can be very important. For other people, divestment of sexual identity can be freeing, allowing them to honor the idiosyncrasy of their sexuality and detaching their personal identities from political strife. Christians need to not just judge existing sexual categories, we need to make new culture. For people who see themselves as cast out of their families, cast out of churches, even cast to hell, because of their sexual past or present, and that's any sexual identity that happens, we need to offer communities and spiritual practices that help people remember their true identities as beloved, and make sense of sin and its consequences in light of that brighter truth. For people who no longer take sexual holiness seriously, we need to announce God's love so beautifully that they are compelled to get with the program. And for all of us, we need to cultivate habits of conversation and conflict resolution that will help Christians discuss what sexual holiness really means and how we will live together in unity even when we don't come to consensus. That's the pattern, big, small, big, small. But I also promised you a practice. If we only consider sex and religion with our words, our brains, our talking, and our thinking, we're only going to get so far. We need to live what we know, live into what we don't know, practice what we preach. And I do mean practice. When you're playing whack-a-mole, there's no second chance. You either get the mole or you don't. You either win enough reward tickets to get that big fun dip packet from the teenager at the prize counter, or you don't. But when you practice, you get to try over and over again. You know you're not always going to get it right because you're practicing. And while baseball, violin, or theater practices lead up to performances, life doesn't. It's all practice. The practice is smiling. You know, we could probably try it right now. You look so much better. And you look good before. A smile is at the nexus of gender, sexuality, and spirituality. You always smile as a man, as a woman, and something of your sexuality shines through. Something of your heart and spirit shines through, too. Something of the image of God given to each of us at our creation. What can you do with a smile? You can make yourself attractive. You can use a smile to attract attention, friendship, conversation, love, delight, beauty, maybe even romance, marriage, sex, or babies. You can make your face friendly, surprised, bemused, pretty, handsome, available. Practices can become habits, repeated so many times they seem automatic and they shape us deeply. Think about how you habituate your sexuality. I read an article about alcoholism that discussed the importance of rehabituating your life. The article said sobriety shouldn't just be an endless series of choices against, choices to abstain. It should be a choice for something. But it isn't always easy for an addict to find and value that something. I think it's a compelling parallel to sexual holiness. Christian sexuality shouldn't be an endless series of choices against, living in an absence, living against, living without. It's important to establish habits or repeated practices that influence our sexuality for the good. This could be beauty practices, friendships, flirting, dating, reading, praying, communal life, worship. It could be the pursuit of healing or serving. It could be marriage, child raising, or well-supported celibacy. It could be corporate practices, such as gathering together on a Saturday morning to carry forward intelligent, civil, and respectful dialogue about things that Christians can't ever agree about. And all this could start with a smile. Smiling as a spiritual practice? Does it sound silly? Does it sound trivial? Well, I don't know what the future holds for issues of sexual diversity in American churches, but I feel certain of this. We aren't going to think, talk, analyze, fight, vote, or debate our way to peace and unity. The Spanish poet Antonio Machado said it well. Se hace camino al andar. We make the road by walking it. Smiling as we go can only help. Thank you.
the norm doesn't really need to be problematized or elaborated upon, because the norm is normal. It's fine. We need to talk about all the things that have gone wrong so that we can help them become normal. In very blunt fashion, that's kind of how it works. Non-heterosexuality is really a big category of negation. It's really a big category of what is not. And all those alphabets, all those labels are, for the most part, attempts to make positive something that's been maligned, to make visible something that's been invisible. But at some point, it kind of bumps up against that. Like, why is, and if, sexual minorities are, by any measure, less than 5% of the population, but there's so much work being done around naming and categorizing and studying and making sense of, while the 95% is just sort of there because it's normal. Race is a great parallel, right? It's really hard for whites to even see that they have a race. And sometimes, I teach anthropology, my students will say, like, I don't really have, those people are interesting, I don't really have any culture. I'm white, but that doesn't mean anything, does it? It's just kind of nothing.
I think that
it's hard for categories of privilege to perceive themselves or for us to even talk about them as much as we talk about the not one.
I think the thing that strikes me the most is like that 95% clearly is not all the same. Like, there's no way 95% of our country orients our sexuality exactly the same way. So like where are the words describing that 95%? Like that's what I'm curious about.
And some researchers who study, I read this great article by it's a team of scientists and who are sort of like leading people who do national level surveys about American sexuality. But on the chapter on homosexuality, they said it's really frustrating to work on this topic because what is it that we're talking about? If you read all the scientific literature about homosexuality, people define it differently. It's people who have same-sex sex. It's people who want to have same-sex sex. It's people who think about same-sex sex with what level of frequency. My favorite definition is after ejaculatory inevitability. After you're past the point of no return, what do you think about then? How do you set up that study? I do not know. But the idea there was that you can tell yourself whatever you want about your sexuality and control your thoughts and behaviors to a point. That's a moment where we have much less control. So how do we know how many homosexuals there are, or what we should, or the sex lives of the majority? It's just a very tricky thing. And what these researchers ended up doing was making a Venn diagram with respect to homosexuality, saying people who have ever had any same-sex thoughts or fantasies, people who have ever had any same-sex behaviors, and then there was another, I think maybe people who self-identify, that was another one. Because self-identification, that would be a very different group of people than the others. And so they try to create this Venn diagram and come up with a number of the people at the nexus of the, the three different circles. It's a very, for all that's at stake, you'd think we would talk about these things with more precision, but we really don't.
I guess on that same note, how long have we been using science to classify things? I mean, obviously science has always been around, but when do we start applying it to cultural things that are not necessarily that easy to measure?
Mm-hmm.
And is there like a history? Is that a new
thing? No, I mean,
it's science to, figure these things out.
For Christians, it just speaks to the importance of having deep investment in the breadth and the historical depth of our tradition. Because, the scientific revolution is how many hundreds of years old? 400 or 500 years old? My professional life, the way that I speak, the way that I research issues is all shaped by that little chunk of the Western tradition. And we also do theology and read our Bibles informed by that tradition. Prior to that point, religious in the West,
wouldn't happen in a different kind of, in a pre-scientific context. And so I think again, taking the long view and taking the broad view, seeing how do Christians in other societies think about these issues, how is sexual difference even framed in different places where there's third genders or three sexes or five genders, and how do Christians engage with those categories. That kind of input, I just think is, I mean, actually, I'm like an anthropologist, I like cross-cultural study. I think it brings so much because we just live in our context and take it to be the whole world, you know, when it's in your gut.
Going off that, I think you alluded to this in your book, where you said that the problem with the politics around sexuality is that we as Christians are, instead of going, instead of, you know, seeking Jesus in that process, we're going off of our culture, of what the culture tells us. Like, the culture tells us that it's normal to be, you know, this ideal of the heterosexual, so that's what you have to be, instead of seeking that sexual holiness. And I think also, you know, I think going off that, one of the problems is that when people say, like, oh, well, is it, you know, wrong to be gay? Is it right to do this? It's just like, well, you're asking the wrong questions. Like, how do I be a better neighbor? Like, how do I, you know, love the poor?
Well, I think in a very, I don't mean it simply. Sure. Seek first the kingdom of God.
Right.
If you know what your center is, not just in individual discipleship, but even as a church, what is our central purpose? I think that would help put issues or challenges or even theology itself. It would help put it in a context around a more meaningful center. And I know for me, gender has been a huge issue in my life. And I come from a tradition that says, just read the Bible literally. It says clearly what you should do. Do it. And I have found it impossible to have a biblical marriage. I didn't have anyone willing to arrange a marriage for me when I was because biblical stories exist in context. I don't have that context. I cut my hair short. I wear gold jewelry. I don't cover my head. I have the primary career in my family. My husband raised children. I have a PhD. I mean, those things were all, for me, not, in my religious background, profoundly taboo. And for me, seeking Jesus or seeking the kingdom of God and finding my conscience, testing that out with Christians from the past, Christians of other cultures, Christians beyond my immediate church and tradition. It didn't allow me, you know, utter freedom. I was still bound to the community, but I made my community broader, and which I think is more Christian. But for me, that's been a journey throughout my life of saying, people are telling me, I think I'm saying it clearly, but crafting my own kind of marriage or my own kind of gender journey, which is in no way literally like the stories of women in the Bible, has made me think about context. That context, my context, where do I have freedom, where are the bounds, which voices of authority help me think that through. There was something back here first.
I was going to say that to hold that tension to, because, you know, that we're talking about definitions of homosexuality, that they catch-all terms, or just for simplicity's sake, is a negation, based on negation. But then now we're working, you know,
religious vows create a pathway of discipline for my sexuality. And some of the rules and the standards of sexual identity don't apply all that well. Like my students are almost all unmarried. You know, they will talk about the importance of what you want and your sexual feelings are very strong, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, well, what about me as a wife and a mother? My sexual feelings are very strong for that other person. And they say, oh, not for you. You don't get to do that, right? Because you decided to be married. So we need to also think about that. The logic that we use to think about sexuality and identity, it should work